You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful, picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the first 30 minutes, we're going to be talking to Buck Keeley. And then, of course, we're going to be talking on open lines. And so you're welcome to call in. In fact, you're welcome to call in if you'd like to talk to Bucks and FMCCatalog.com. We're going to be talking about being prepared to garden in case we have a problem. And we do know that at least the elite who run the world are planning on food problems. That is why they spent countless millions of dollars on the Doomsday Seed Bank, and you can check it out. It's about 800 miles from the North Pole on a frozen island where they have frozen all sorts of seeds. So they will be able to start in all over again after the coming catastrophe. What's the catastrophe? I'm not certain what it is, but they obviously are not putting out literally millions, probably hundreds of millions of dollars to maintain the Doomsday Seed Bank unless they know that a major catastrophe is coming. And that's why you should begin making preparations and beginning to learn to garden. So basically, if something should happen to our food supply, as the elite who run the world anticipate, that you and your family will be able to survive. Buck Keeley, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's my pleasure.
Well, it's the middle of winter, so what should people be doing now in preparation for their gardens and learning how to be able to grow their own food in the weeks and months that lie ahead?
Well, the winter time is a kind of a two-pronged attack. One is where you provide fresh nutrition for yourself in the garden, and the best way to do that is through sprouting. Either soil sprouting or seed sprouting, you get fresh sprouts for yourself and your family in 3 to 5 days after sprouting. There's nothing quite so good as taking some fresh broccoli sprouts or reddish sprouts and sprinkling them on top of some pasta or something like that. And it's a good source of nutrients and vitamins that you can't get this time of year any other way. The second is preparing your garden for this coming spring. Most of your listeners by now, if they plant garlic, ought to have it in the garden. Garlic, for it to produce the heads, has to have a freeze before it puts on heads. So normally, somewhere towards the end of the growing season, in October, November, you ought to be planting your garlic clothes for next year's garlic, as well as that you ought to be preparing yourself for the early season planting, such as your potatoes that will go in most areas somewhere between February and March, getting your seed potatoes lined out and ready to go. For you who are in the areas where you're at a 5A, 6A in the growing charts right now, that you ought to be looking at getting your compost ready to go. So it's important now to have things you're doing in composting and getting that soil ready for next year's gardening, getting your garden plan. It's a good thing to take a piece of paper and draw out your gardening space if you're a container gardening or if you're doing raised bed gardening or if you're a flat gardener to plan where you're going to plant so you know how much seed you're going to need and rotate your crops around. So there's a lot of things to do this time of year.
All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment for our guest, Buck Keeley of SeedCatalog.com, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And there's a lot to know about this. You need to know the zone that you're in. Maybe when we get back, Buck can explain the zones and where you can learn about them. And then, of course, you need to think about sprouting. Do you know how to sprout. Well, we'll talk a little bit about that. But if you have a question or comment, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and give us a call here at Radio Liberty. Well, basically, Buck, now, as you were mentioning the composting, so people should have been composting all along. What about going just down to the flower store, to the supply store, and buying compost? Or would it be a lot better off to make our own compost?
Well, it makes sense to make your own compost. That anyone who has a yard has materials to compost with, and anybody that cooks has materials to compost with. That there should never be anything to go to the refuse center or to the garbage collection that could be used for other purposes. It's not just to have the mentality that we want to take care of our planet, but the fact we want to take care of our resources we own. And so why go down to the big box store, to the gardening supply store, and buy a bag of compost when you could do it yourself? And it's as simple as taking your leftover vegetable waste when you make a salad or for the vegetables that you eat during dinner, for the leftover things like the leaves as they turn brown and the grass clippings that you clip them, putting them in a pile and turning them a couple of times a year. It's as simple as putting it in the back corner of your lot and don't let anything go to waste. The paper towels, the liners out of your coffee pot, cardboard, all that material readily composts and turns back into the basic components that it's comprised out of, carbon and nitrogen. And that's what your soil really needs. So it doesn't make any sense to take that stuff and put it in a plastic bag and send it off and pay somebody to haul it to the garbage. What makes sense is when you take that and put it in a compost bowl and pile in the back of your yard. And so compost is as simple as this. It's organic material that's allowed to deteriorate. And you can do that either naturally by just putting it in a pile and turning it once or twice a year, or you can expedite that by putting it in containers, such as a barrel container, or you can take a couple of three pallets and tie them together and put it in there. And if you really want to speed it up, you can put a tarp on top of it and that'll hold that heat in and help the material to decompose even more rapidly. But if you walk out into the forest and you walk across the forest floor and you see that 6 or 8 inches of very rich, deep compost soil, that's what you're doing. It's the leaves and the other debris that breaks down naturally with the use of time and moisture. So composting is the greatest tool that a home gardener has. And if you buy your compost, that's okay, as long as you're buying something that hasn't been composted through, like, the local landfill where everything in the world, that no matter what's been put on it, is put into the green material and composted. But if you make your own compost, you know what kind of chemicals have gone into it, and you know what kind of nutrients you're going to get out of it. So composting is just common sense. Everybody should be.
Okay, hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and my wife is simply asking, is there anything we shouldn't be putting in the compost pile? Are there any things that we specifically avoid putting in the compost pile?
Yeah, there's two or three things that you want to avoid putting in the compost pile. One is any type of meat, not because it'll ruin your compost, but it'll bring in critters. If you have issues with raccoons or with the local dogs or cats coming in, they'll come there and they'll eat that meat. The second is...
You don't want to put any meat into it, okay, fine.
Any proteins. You don't want to put it in there because they'll go rampant. They'll stink and the animals come and eat it. And the second thing is you don't want to put anything in there that has any type of pathogen in it or carcinogen in it. An example of that would be is taking something like OSB, oriented strand board, or treated material that sawdust has been cut from a treated lumber. Anything that has chemicals added to it, you don't want to put it in your compost pile. But anything else is fair game. Cardboard and newspaper, a lot of people are concerned about the ink. They're soy-based, so you don't have to worry about that. They're not going to be chemicals that's going to ruin your compost pile. So that your cardboard and your newspaper and your leftover papers, if you shred your documents and your important papers, that goes into your compost pile. That your leaves and your grass clippings, that goes in your compost pile. The scraps from the table minus protein go into the compost pile. And it'll help your garden, but it'll help you also be more in tune to what's going on in your own life. And you want to remember as well on the compost pile, if there's a basic rule of thumb, it doesn't make any difference what you do, it's going to compost. But if you want to heat up your compost, you want to have about 80% brown material, that's carbon, and about 20% green material, that's nitrogen. I had one of our new neighbors come over to see us, and he found out who we were and what we do, and he said, I've been composting for years, and I cannot get my compost to heat up. I can't get it to get warm. And so I talked with him a little bit, and he had only been putting ground material in his compost. And I told him to take a few green things and shred them up and put it in his compost. He came back the other day, and he had 130 degrees in his compost pile because he's putting nitrogen into his compost. Green equals nitrogen. Brown equals carbon. And about a 20 to 80% ratio between your nitrogen and your carbon will heat that thing up. And it's important to heat up your compost pile because it does a couple of things. One is it kills out pathogens, and the second thing it does is it kills out seed. If you put in your compost pile such things as horse manure, or if you put in your compost pile the waste out of your garden, if you have a bumper crop of zucchini, and you've canned all you're going to can, and you've eaten all you're going to eat, and you've dehydrated all you're going to dehydrate, and your neighbors roll up their windows when they come to your house and lock their doors, so you wind up putting that into your compost pile. What you want to do is heat up that compost pile so it kills the seed. And that's what the 2080 will do. It'll bring it up to around 120 to 130 degrees. Cover it'll bring it up to 140, and it'll kill those seeds so that when you put your compost into your garden, you don't have any unwanted guests showing up through grass seed or wheat seed or through vegetable seed you put in there.
And, of course, Buck has told us in the past that certainly if you use horse manure, many times this will have seeds in it. Or you've used cow manure, why you don't get that, and so you don't have so much of a problem of beginning to grow things, certainly in the manure itself. Certainly, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Buck Keeley. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Buck, would you like to get your telephone number and your website out there so people would know how they can get in touch with you, be able to get the seeds and the fertilizers and the other material that you make available through your seedcatalog.com?
Your listeners will find us on the World Wide Web at seedcatalog.com. That's all one word, seedcatalog.com. That's seedcatalog.com. Type that into your address bar, the browser that you use. That'll take us to our website. There you're going to find a lot of interesting articles about the importance of heirloom seed and the non-GNO movement. And then you click on Shop on Seed. That'll take you to our store where we sell our products at. If you do not have access to the World Wide Web, if you'll give us a call at 1-808-982-7782, that's 1-808-982-7782. Give us a call. We'll be glad to help you over the phone with the sales of seeds or any other information you need.
All right, fine. I'm going to ask you just to try to talk just a little louder. It just seems though I've got my board's turned all the way up, and suddenly I think people can hear you, but I think they do better if you talk a little louder. And if you're out there in the listening audience, I have a question for Buck, certainly having to do with beginning to make your preparations for the difficult times that lie ahead. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, would you like to talk a little bit about the seed banks that you offer that have these heirloom seeds and they are stored away so that they can actually put them down either in a refrigerator or in a freezer or bury them in the ground so that those seeds would be good for 10 to 20 years?
Absolutely. It's important. I think it's incumbent upon us to take steps that prepares for the future. That I'm getting old, not quite as old as you, Dr. Stan. I have a little daylight between my years and your years, but I'm at the 60-year mark, and I have seen things change so much since I was a teenager till now. Our government has become oppressive and unstable, and there's a movement to control people's lives. The old adage is true. He who controls the food controls the people. And so there is a movement taking place not only to control the health care of America, but also the food supply, that we move to where now almost half of our population receives some types of food subsidy from the government. And so there's a dependency on the government, and I'm not a conspiracist so much, although I believe there is a conspiracy, but I do believe that there is a movement, and it will be taking place, to limit access to food. I think it's prudent, and I think it's only right for us to prepare our own lives for sustainability and for the ability to provide for ourselves in the times that are uncertain in the future. And one of the ways you do that is you provide immediate food. I think everyone who has any prudence at all has foodstuffs on hand for at least 30 days that they can consume and eat. Dehydrated food, MREs, canned food, things like that they have on hand. But the second line is having seeds. It is so important for us to have a renewable source of food. You can't feed a cow unless you have grain, and you can't plant grain unless you have seed. You cannot have sustainability without the ability to renew your food supply, and that's where we come in. We provide for your listeners what we call seed banks, and what they are is a miniature version of what Bill Gates is doing and the other elites of the North Pole. It allows you to own and possess seeds that are sustainable and renewable. The seeds we sell in the seed banks are what is called heirloom seeds. That means they've not been tampered with genetically, and they have not been hyper-hybrid, so that when you plant a tomato and you grow that tomato and you harvest the tomato, those seeds will produce that same tomato. You harvest the seeds and you store them, and next year you plant them. You can't do that with seeds that's been hyper-hybrid. So it's important for your listeners to know the seeds we sell are only heirloom seeds. And what we do, along with selling our seeds by a single packet or by our packs where we sell for a large backyard garden or a small back garden, what we do is we provide what we call seed banks. And that is where we take seeds that will plant an acre in the basic seed bank and seeds that will plant a half acre in the personal seed bank. And we pack those seeds in their individual packets inside a Mylar bag. A Mylar bag is a metal-based bag that, when it is sealed with heat, is impervious to light and moisture and insects, which protects the seeds. Then we put those seeds inside of a tri-wall PVC pipe. It's a rubberized interior PVC pipe, which is so important, so if it gets either frozen and stepped on, or if it gets run over with an automobile, it doesn't crack. It bends and comes back to its shape. And so we protected the seeds from light. We protected the seeds from moisture. We protected the seeds from insects. And then what your listeners do is they put that in a refrigerator, a freezer, in a hole in the backyard, a foot or two deep to stabilize the temperature, in a root cellar, in a basement, someplace where the temperature doesn't get above 80 or 90 degrees. Now, the enemy of seeds is light, water, insects, and heat. As long as you keep those seeds stored at cool temperatures, they'll have germination rate to 90%+ in 20 years from now. So what we do is we pack those seeds in an environment that protects them from everything but the heat. And as long as you keep those seeds in a cool place, 20 years from now, you can cut open the seed bank and plant the seeds. It is a no-loss situation. If nothing happens, and 5 years from now, everything is rosy and all of our fears have been dispelled and we don't have any problems, you open up the seed bank, you plant a garden. But on the other hand, if the worst-case scenario takes place, you open up the seed bank and you have life and you have the ability to barter for more goods and services you need. So that's what a seed bank is.
Okay, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Buck, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. And we have Sandy calling from Yakima, Washington. Hi, Sandy.
Hello, Dr. Stan. I had a couple of questions for Mr. Keeley.
Fine, you go right ahead.
I was wondering, what kind of container would you recommend to sprout alfalfa seeds?
You talking about long-term or short-term?
I don't know.
Well, there's three concepts of storage. One is for near use, one is for now use, and one is for long use. And for the now use, if you have alfalfa seed, are you sprouting the seed or are you looking to plant it?
No, I haven't yet. I don't know anything about it, so
okay,
I thought I'd better ask.
You're storing the seed for near use. Where are you going to use it in the next 3 to 4 months? Just put it in a Ziploc bag, put it in a dark place in your cabinet where the temperature doesn't get high. It'll be good. If you want to have it for a longer storage, put it in a mason jar, seal it up tight where the moisture can't get into it. Put it in a dark, cool place. It'll keep for a couple, 3 years. And if you want to keep it for longer than that, then put it in a Mylar bag seal it, and then put it in the PVC pipe and seal it. It'll keep up to 20 years.
My second question was, do you just use a couple of seeds, or do you use several?
Hold that thought. We're going to have to go to a break here, but you hang on there, Sandy. We'll be back in a moment.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Sandy, go right ahead with your question.
Yes, do you use just a couple of seeds or several?
Well, most people who are using alfalfa seed are using them for sprouts, fresh sprouts.
I can't hardly hear you. I don't know if it's my phone or what's going on.
Well, basically, he said that most people use grow alfalfa if it grows it for sprouts, but go right ahead.
Pardon me?
Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay. That most people who are using alfalfa are using it for sprouts, or they're using it for ground cover on their garden where they till it in at the end of the year. Alfalfa is a very inexpensive seed if you buy it in bulk. But most folks who are buying alfalfa buy it for sprouts. And the way that you sprout is about 2 to 3 tablespoons of alfalfa seed. You put them in a jar overnight and let them hydrate with water overnight. Then you drain them off.
Okay.
And you put them in a sprouting container, whether you're using a bag sprouter or a flat sprouter, or even just a mason jar that you put it in with a piece of paper towel on top and a lid on it that you will let set in a dark place on the cabinet top, and you rinse them every day. And that 2 to 3 tablespoons after about 5 to 6 days will fill that mason jar full of fresh green sprouts. And if you've not had alfalfa sprouts, they are excellent on sandwiches, they're excellent on salads, or they're just good.
Yeah.
I keep them around, grab them by the handful as my snacks during the day. And so most folks, when they do alfalfa sprouts, they do about 2 to 3 tablespoons in a quart jar or in a sprouter container, and that will give you, in somewhere in 5 to 6 days, about a quart of fresh sprouts. And they'll keep, if you rinse them off and put them in your refrigerator, they'll keep for about a week fresh.
Okay,
Sandy, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, do you have any other questions you want to ask?
No, that was it. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, I guess, of course, it's Buck Keeley, and we're talking about certainly preparing for what may be difficult times, hoping it's not going to be. But, well, Buck, certainly, do you think that more and more people out across America are beginning to realize that there's at least the potential danger and beginning to make preparations? Are you seeing any reflection of that concern?
But, you know, we've moved to Hawaii, and part of the reasons why we moved here is the ability to be sustainable. The rainfall is right here. There is not a shortage of water in the near future. I was talking to a realtor who was a part of our group that was looking for some gardening advice, and she said that they have had a number of people that have bought in on the Big Island for the simple purpose that they want to have a bug-out place where it's sustainable, where the temperatures are appropriate for gardening year-round, where you don't have to worry about heating and cooling or about the water flow. And so she was surprised at the number of people that have been in the last 2 years buying property just for that just-in-case for a place to bug out to. The people around here, I'm dealing with, this is a new element for me here as I'm creating new relationships and a new network of people that we are associating with. And the vast majority of the people here that are in the last 5 years have come for that sustainability concern over what's going to happen. And it's a variety of things. There's some folks that are worried about the government. There's some folks that are worried about natural catastrophe. There's other people worrying about financial upheaval. But there's a heightened sense of awareness that things are not going to be like they are in 5 years from now. That things are changing. And the people who are proactive, people who are taking measures to protect themselves and their families, are the ones that's going to be not just survivors, which I don't want to just survive. I don't want to be on the edge and just barely.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, of course, is Buck Keeley from SeedCatalog.com. Buck is certainly living over in Hawaii at the present time, and he said that there are an awful lot of people. The realtors have told him a lot of people are coming over there and buying a place there because they are concerned about what's going on, and we don't know whether there's going to be a financial catastrophe or some sort of an economic collapse or whether it's going to be perhaps a war of some sort, but they certainly want want to have be a place where they can be able to suddenly look after themselves, their families, and sustain themselves. So right now, before we go any further, let's go to Jay, who's calling us from Soquel, California. And again, if you'd like to get talk to Buck, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Jay, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, sir. I was wondering about growing like potatoes.
Growing potatoes. Okay, go
right?
ahead.
And also peas. You know, I mean peanuts.
Well, let's start with the potatoes because potatoes are entirely different than peas. What about growing potatoes, Buck? You mentioned that's something that people would get started maybe in another month or two, even here in places like where we live. How do they grow potatoes, and what's the trick to that?
The potatoes are probably one of the most powerful crops to grow that a person can grow, and they're probably the easiest. Potatoes do not have to have really good soil. They thrive in most soils very easily. And potatoes are not planted from seeds. They're planted by propagation, and that's from potatoes that exist. The best way to get your seed potatoes is go to an organic store. And the reason why I say organic store is that the organic potatoes are not sprayed with inhibitors that slows down the process of forming hives. If you go down to the local grocery store and buy a bag of potatoes, it's been treated with chemicals to postpone the putting on of the eyes of the potatoes. Organic potatoes have not been treated, and so the eyes will naturally form. And so, depending on the area you're at, about 6 weeks before your last frost, and if you're in California, if you're in the lower areas, about any time, go down to the organic store, get yourself some potatoes, whichever kind you like, russet or your golden harems or your yellow potatoes, yellow Yukon gold, whatever you like, and put them in a plastic bag with a paper towel that's been dampened and put them underneath the sink for about a week, and they're going to start to produce ice. The potatoes, when they sense dark, cool, damp environment, they're ready to put on ice. And you take those potatoes and you cut them up, and each one of those pieces that have at least one eye on it. Now, if you're container gardening, and most of my potatoes, just because I'm lazy, I container garden because I don't like to dig them up. I take a 5-gallon bucket, I put 3-4 holes in the bottom of it so it drains, and then I put about 4 inches of soil on the bottom of it. I put the potatoes in there and put soil on top of them, and as the potatoes break through the ground and begin to put on the greens, I fill up the soil every week or two. I put a little more soil in, and the green part of the tomato grows all the way to the top of that 5-gallon bucket. And then I just turn them loose. I feed them a little good organic fertilizer and keep them watered. And when the greens turn brown on top, the green foliage turns brown, they'll bloom, they'll turn brown. Dump that 5-gallon container upside down, you'll wind up somewhere around 10 to 12 pounds of potato. Very simple to do.
Oh, no, before we go on, we're all out of time. I want you to get out your telephone number and your website one more time. And Jay, did you have anything else you wanted to say before we let you go? Jay, are you there? Oh, I hope we didn't lose Jay.
Oh, me, sir?
Yes, uh-huh. Okay.
Well, I was wondering about peanuts. Oh. That would be hard to grow peanuts here.
Okay, fine. Well, first of all, let's get the information out, and you hang on after we cut off. My producer wants to talk to you, so don't hang up, Jay. Buck, why don't you get your telephone number out one more time?
All right, you'll find us on the World Wide Web at seedcatalog.com, seedcatalog.com, and you can reach us at 1-808-982-7782, 1-808-982-7782, and we'd be glad to help you on the telephone, make your order.
And then, of course, Jay wanted to know about peanuts, growing peanuts. Is that something that can be readily done?
Yes, peanuts, they like warm climates. They like warm, dry climates. And so if you're in a wet, damp area, make sure you provide cover over the peanuts with plastic so that the rain doesn't reach them regular. Sandy soil, loose soil, like all root crops, just pick up some peanut seed, put it in a loose, sandy soil. Temperatures above 70 degrees, up to 100 degrees, keep them moderately wet, and they'll grow like crazy.
Okay, Jay, does that answer your question?
Yes, sir, it does.
Okay, fine. Hang on there. I'm going to give you back to our producer, and I'll go ahead and give her your telephone number, too, would you? And we'll be right back in just a moment. Today, our guest has been Buck Keeley. When we get back, well, it's going to be open lines. Our number is 1-800-188-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Buck, God bless you. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Blessings to you. Bye now.
This is Dr. Stan back here at the Genesis Communication Network, and so it's going to be open lines for the rest of the hour. Out there in the listening audience, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here at 464-8295 in the Central Coast of California, and we'll talk about really whatever you'd like to talk about. In fact, that's what open lines is all about. But maybe we can just start out talking a little bit about what is going on over in the Middle East. And as you know, certainly we have killed about 120,000 innocent civilians there in Syria. We've turned that nation certainly into a chaotic area. 5 years ago, Syria was peaceful. Certainly the people lived there. Yes, certainly they had an authoritarian government under the Shia government. Alawite apparently relied to the Shia, and there are a lot of Sunnis there who didn't like the government. But you must understand, this is not a civil war. They had a prosperous prosperous society, and certainly most of the countries over there are authoritarian. Certainly Saudi Arabia is an authoritarian dictatorship where they chop off people's hands and feet, where they certainly stone women to death for adultery, castrate men for adultery, certainly behead people on a regular basis. They do this every weekend. People can come and watch the festivities as they commit these atrocities. They have a total totalitarian dictatorship. When was the last time you saw a program on television in America about the ruthless dictatorship they have in Saudi Arabia? And you're not seeing any because, of course, the media is controlled, and they focus our attention on the fact that Assad in Syria was a dictator, not democratically elected. And yet he protected the Christians there. He protected the Sunnis, and basically they lived in a prosperous society until we sent in mercenaries. And believe me, all of the people there are mercenaries. Almost all of them are mercenaries. They've been recruited from all over the Middle East. They've been recruited from Europe. They are well paid by your government and by the CIA. They are armed, and they are certainly trained and by our government, because we wanted to overthrow that government. Now, we did the same thing in Libya, and basically, I've heard various studies, different figures. If you go to the internet, you'll find out that we killed about 30,000 people when we created a revolution in Libya. But I've talked to people there who say it's closer to 100,000 people that have been killed in Libya because of the revolution that we incited. We did the same thing in Tunisia. I don't know how many tens of thousands we killed there. We sort of did the same thing in Egypt, and they killed certainly thousands and thousands of people as a result of the fact that we overthrew the government there in Egypt and now installed a new government. And then, of course, we overthrew that government, and now we have another government in place. And these countries are all chaotic as a direct result of American foreign policy. What in heaven's name are we doing? Well, we are trying to install governments under Sharia law all throughout that part of the world. That is why, certainly, the radicals that we are paying to go into Syria want to install a government under Sharia law. The people don't want to live under Sharia law, but we want them to live under Sharia law and become victims of this radical form of Islam. That is exactly what we have done in both Iraq and Afghanistan. And the United States military supervised the writing of a new constitution for both of those countries. And in both of those countries, we installed governments under Sharia law over the objections of the people. But it doesn't matter what the people want. We are creating governments there under Sharia law, under this radical form of Islam. Why? Because we are creating the best enemy money could buy. If you're going to have a organized society here in America, you have to be able to convince the people that we have an enemy. And so if you don't have an enemy, you create an enemy. The people over in the Middle East that want to live their lives and have their settle their own problems, but of course we're over there, and we are investing a tremendous amount of money putting in these radical Islamic governments. And why in heaven's name would we do that? Well, because I think we're going to have a war over in that part of the world. I think it's only a matter of time before we have a nuclear war over there. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. We've talked to people, very knowledgeable people, who tell us that Saudi Arabia has nuclear weapons. Well, we certainly know that Russia and China have nuclear weapons. We know certainly that Israel has nuclear weapons. And I think it's only a matter of time before that whole area breaks out. And I believe we're going to be involved in a nuclear war, whether we want to or not. And remember what it talks in the Bible about Babylon, last Babylon. And the ship captains can see Babylon burning. Well, I think Babylon, this is my view, you may disagree with it, but I think Babylon is the financial center of the world. That's what it tells us in the Holy Scriptures. And what is the financial center of the world today? It's New York City, ladies and gentlemen. New York City, right here in the United States. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We have D calling from Post Falls on Idaho, and hopefully our producer will pass D over and we can talk to him, talk to D. But our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. It's open lines. And D, how are you doing tonight?
Not so bad. It's a different hour and a different audience, so I thought I'd briefly revisit the ethanol issue.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, this is actually a bad idea to spike ethanol in gasoline in some engines, especially small engines and other engines with aluminum components. And there's two reasons for this. The first is ethanol is hydrophilic. In other words, it attracts water. So if ethanol is spiked fuel, is spiked in gasoline, it doesn't matter whether you would have E5, E10, E15, et cetera. If it's not used promptly, it will, over time, undergo a phase separation. Now, you might know this already, Dr. Stan, but water weighs about 8 pounds a gallon. Gas weighs about 6 pounds a gallon. So guess what happens? The water settles in the bottom of your carburetor, and your engine won't start.
Well, I'm not an expert on this subject. We did have Charlie Peters on last night or the night before talking about this. And certainly I have no strong feelings one way or the other, but I'm just not quite so certain that it's really to our benefit to have ethanol added to the gasoline. And I suspect somebody's making an awful lot of money off of this. In fact, I think so many of the things that are mandated by Washington, D.C. are designed to allow certain people to make a lot of money at the expense of all the rest of us. Is that your feeling?
Yeah, that would definitely be my feeling. I don't think the government should interfere and distort the marketplace by creating artificial supply and demand. But the other reason it's a bad idea is it tends to oxidize the aluminum part, so it reduces the longevity of it, and then it acts as a solvent, so it tends to compromise seals. Now, I am open-minded, however, enough to say that the real ethanol advocate that your other caller was trying to remember last night is David Bloom, and he is the author of a book called Ethanol Can Be a Gas. And the name of the author is David Bloom, and he's a huge ethanol advocate, and I think under some situations it might make sense if you're using a good old cast iron engine or something. But the other little tip I got for, like, the preppers and so forth, as I mentioned before, any ethanol spike fuel has a dramatically shorter lifespan than pure gasoline, and pure gasoline will last up to 5 years if you put BHT in it. Apparently, I haven't tried this, there's only two local stations in North Idaho that will sell ethanol-free fuel, but you can go on a airport ramp, a general aviation ramp, and you want to think Cessnas, not Boeing. The little airplanes, the little piston-powered airplanes, they stock and use ethanol-free high-octane motor gasoline because the FAA allows some airplanes to use that. So apparently you can buy ethanol-free fuel at airports also, although you will pay a premium. You're probably going to pay something like $5 a gallon.
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. It's open line, so if you're out there and you'd like to certainly call us on any subject, we'd be glad to talk about it. But one of the things that was brought up the other evening was that in Brazil, why almost all the fuel that's used there is ethanol? Now, have they designed the cars in Brazil so that the ethanol doesn't damage the motors? Do you have any idea or any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, I definitely have thoughts on that. Keep in mind it's a subtropical or even tropical climate. In a temperate climate here where we have, like, snowblowers and everything, the phase separation issue is much worse, and you're having a lot of problems with cold starting. And the vapor pressure of alcohol is much lower than than gasoline. It's a lower volatile. So that's definitely going to work better. All things being equal, it will always work better in a warmer climate like Brazil. The other thing, too, is they have specifically modified the engines, and most of them have oxygen sensors, which monitors the amount of oxygenate in the fuel. So their fancy high-tech computerized cars. On the other hand, such engines would be unlikely to operate after an EMP. A good old Briggs & Stratton that uses carburation would definitely work after an EMP because it doesn't have any computer in it.
All right, fine. Well, for whatever reason, they certainly have a tendency to use the ethanol. I think it's maybe because Brazil didn't have any, at least until recently, any stocks of petroleum products down there, and so that they were using the sugar cane, and they were manufacturing the ethanol, and they were fueling their engines with that. And it may very well be they designed the engine so they would tolerate it better. I'm not certain. Maybe somebody out there in the listening audience knows something more about that than I do. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or 464-8295. It's something we don't really think about. But, of course, apparently there is legislation pending in Washington, D.C. to do away with the mandate that they have to add ethanol to our gasoline. And I really don't think it's beneficial at all. I think it's done really, of course, to justify, you know, using the ethanol, raising the price of the gasoline. And I think somebody's making an awful lot of money over it. And I think with so many of the pieces of legislation that come out of Washington, D.C., it has nothing to do with what's best for us. It's the fact that in Washington, D.C. today, we have the finest politicians money could buy. Basically, of course, the big corporations come in, and they give massive amounts of money to their favorite congressmen. And those favorite congressmen, then that money doesn't go directly to the congressman. It goes so he'll get reelected. And believe me, the people who pay for the elections control the congressmen rather than what's good for the people is the people who put the money up. Unfortunately, this is the way democracy works and why democracy is always a failure and why our founding fathers certainly did not create a democracy. They created a republic where the power of the central government was to be limited so it could never be used to favor one group over another and to enslave the public. Do you go right ahead? Any questions or thoughts you had other than that?
Those points are excellent and well taken. One final point, the ethanol advocates will even admit this, that in many instances there's an under-unity gain with ethanol, which says that you actually have to put more energy into the system to get the fuel. Now, if that results in convenience, well, it's possibly worth it, but it's certainly not worth it if the government's subsidizing it, and it's a giant boondoggle with the expectation that, well, if we create an ethanol infrastructure, it's the old adage, if you build a ballpark, people will play in it. But that's distortion of the market, free marketplace, and I do not believe in that at all.
Well, the difficulty is, of course, we have all of these groups that have subsidies. The farmers have subsidies. The people who grow sugar have subsidies. And suddenly the automotive industry has subsidies. There's subsidies for the farmers and for the subsidies on milk. And basically, it's a wonderful, wonderful system. We live in a utopian society. The only trouble is that we can't afford it. We're spending more than we're taking in, and basically, if the interest rates go up, and they are going to go up, and if we were simply to have with the current level of debt, it was over $17 trillion, certainly if the interest rates went up to 6% instead of the very low rates they have today, you'd be talking about almost a trillion dollars being spent on interest. Now, remember, the federal government only takes in about $2.3 trillion a year, and if you're having to take certainly $1 trillion of that and put it out in interest, well, the whole system collapses. And I think that's what's going to happen. And there really are people who want the system to collapse because they hate America, but they have a plan. Don't you worry, they're going to establish a dictatorship. Dee, thank you so very much for calling. It's really appreciated. And I'm going to ask our producer to pass Tim through from upstate New York so we can get to him. And certainly if our producer will just give us Tim from upstate New York, we'll see what he wants to talk about. But if you're looking at this new agreement that's been made between the Republicans and the Democrats as far as the budget is concerned, all of this is really going to do is allow them to spend more money. We have $1 trillion a year deficit. And what are they going to do? They're telling us, and look and read this and ask me how you can explain it, they're going to have a $26 billion cut in the budget over a 10-year period. A $26 billion a year cut over a 10-year period, that means $2.6 billion a year to counter out the deficit of over $1 trillion a year. Does that make sense to you? No, we live in a world gone mad, ladies and gentlemen. But as Euripides said, those who the gods would make mad, those who the gods would destroy, they first make mad. Let's go to Tim calling from upstate New York. Hi, Tim. How are we doing?
All right. How's it going, Dr.
Doing Matt? Just fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Kind of, you know, in between there, either a question or a comment. I just haven't heard much about the chemtrails recently. When I first started listening, probably a couple of years ago or so, used to talk about them sometimes a few times a week or at least every other week. I was just talking to Barbara about it a little bit.
Well, there's no question that they're chemtrails, but basically they're chemtrails or contrails, and you have to be able to separate them. Basically, if you see the regular planes, the jet planes flying overhead, you'll see the trail behind them. What nobody is telling you is that basically there is nano aluminum in that. And if you doubt that, all you need to do is go up on the internet and type in your search engine, jet fuel, aluminum, you'll find that that's... And then, of course, the chemtrails are where they're actually doing spraying. And they actually do have government planes that are spraying out there. Some people say they're spraying sulfuric acid or some sort of a sulfate to try to decrease global warming. But do you have any information at all on that?
No, I don't. That's why I was calling you, just because I hadn't heard much about it in a while. But, in the past few years, sometimes you devote, like a half a show or whatever to talking about it. But I guess what got me thinking about it again more was I mentioned to your wife, too, just a minute ago that last night you were talking about the airplanes and how they're still using, I guess that must be the piston type, like the propeller, that they're still using leaded aviation gasoline. They're putting lead in it. And they won't, they won't let us have lead in the automobiles, but they're poisoning us from the air with the lead, lead up there.
I'm sure they are, and I really have no question at all that they really do have a program by which they're spraying chemicals into the atmosphere, and that would be aluminum, that would be sulfates, that would be other, and I've forgotten what a couple of the other things that they are spraying.
Well, barium, I think, is
right,
one of
barium,
them.
You're absolutely right. And of course, theoretically, it's all about controlling global warming and creating a shield so the rays of the sun can't get in. Basically, what it does is it increases global warming because the rays of the sun bounce off the earth and they can't get back again. Well, I'll tell you what, I will try to get some programs lined up on chemtrails. How's that?
Sounds great.
Okay, God bless. Thanks so much for calling, and we'll be back in a moment.
Okay, thank you.
Right, son.
this is Dr. Stan back here, and Tim was just calling from upstate New York. Something about chemtrails. I would mention that we do have a 4-CD set on chemtrails. We have another one called Chemtrails Update, and they're both available by calling 1-800-544-8927. We used to do a lot of programs on chemtrails. I have no questions that they're real, that they really are spraying. And it's part of this program of poisoning the water and poisoning the air and poisoning the food and poisoning the children with vaccines, because we don't know what's in a lot of those vaccines. Certainly vaccines can be effective in controlling disease. They've changed the structure of our disease, except now we have millions of children with ADD and ADHD and autoimmune disease and increasing cancer permeating every aspect of our lives, and some of these can be directly related to the response to the immunization. So this immunization, certainly there's a risk-benefit ratio. Some vaccines are worthwhile taking, others are not. You must understand, though, that you should not be taking a large number of vaccines. There are certain ones that you should take and an awful lot that you should not take, because you never know, of course, when they're going to put something in it that could be disastrous to you and to the health of your family. Well, this is the time when we certainly want to mention that my ministry, Radio Liberties, primarily listener-supported, and if you're in a position to help, we'd love to hear from you, especially as we're approaching the end of the year. We'd like to be able to balance out, certainly, our expenses, and so we enter the close the year, certainly without being behind. Many people out there really have given very generously, and I want you to know I really do appreciate those of you who have been able to help finance us, and I know some of you out there are in a financial position where you can't afford to contribute, and so we do ask you, though, to pray for our ministry, for our provision and protection, because this is a ministry, and our real goal is to teach people about the spiritual battle that's going on behind the political and economic battle. For we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization, and right now Christian civilization is being progressively eroded and destroyed because there are people who hate Christianity. The U.S. military is installing governments all throughout the world under Sharia law, I should say, or in the Middle East, under Sharia law. Why would we be installing governments under Sharia law? Because the subversive element that controls our government in Washington, D.C., has an intense hatred of Christianity, which is why they've taken God and prayer and the Ten Commandments and morality out of our schools and out of our nation. And why is it that even the U.S. Army chaplains can't pray in the name of Jesus Christ? Because these people have an intense hatred of Christianity. And we're in real trouble, ladies and gentlemen, because most people do not understand that we have two governments. We have the apparent government that we see with our elected representatives, and then we have another government, a subversive government, a very small group of people who tie into the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission, who worship a different god. Their goal is, of course, to use the financial and military power of the United States to bring about a one-world government. And this is really what it's all about. That's why we have our troops stationed in 130 nations. And basically, this is why we have our troops, 45,000 troops permanently stationed in Germany. Germany is an occupied nation. 35,000 troops permanently stationed in Japan. It's an occupied nation. The average is 25,000 troops permanently stationed. Certainly in South Korea, 11,000 troops permanently stationed in Great Britain, and a similar number in Italy. These are all occupied nations, ladies and gentlemen, and it doesn't matter how the people vote. It is when we have our troops there, we determine what the policies of those governments are, and they will do what they're told. If we had 45,000 Chinese communist troops in Washington, D.C., what do you think our policies would be? It's about time people understood what's really going on, because we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival. If you're in a position to help Radio Liberty, we'd love to hear from you. Again, our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please, please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision, and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for the survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Lowell Ponte, who's certainly one of our very enjoyable guests, who always has a great deal to say, which I think is very well expressed about the events that are taking place today. Lowell, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, what a great honor to be with you, Dr. Stan. And the question on my mind this evening, as we will get to, is perhaps the most provocative you've had on in, at least 45 minutes. And that is, will Obamacare or could Obamacare kill Santa Claus?
All right, fine. Well, I think that's a very, very good subject, because I think basically, of course, Obamacare is designed to destroy medical practice in America, and there was absolutely no reason for this. We had the finest health care system in the world. I may disagree with some parts of it, but certainly overall the patients got excellent health care. Go right ahead with your theme on, will Obamacare kill Santa Claus?
This began to come to mind when a few days ago, I came across a poignant article that a young mother, who was also a novelist, had written in the liberal webzine called Slate.com. Used to belong, maybe still does belong, to what's left of the Washington Post. And her article was titled, "Will Someone Just Please Tell Me How to Lie About Santa?" Her point being, she was a young mother. She had a daughter scarcely 1 year old. Her husband wanted that daughter to experience what he called the magical part of believing in Santa Claus, yet the mother did not want to lie to her daughter, to deal in a fantasy. And this began my thoughts about Santa and what this figure has transformed into. Of course, there was a real Saint Nicholas. He was a bishop in what is now Turkey in the early days of the Christian Church. And he was famed for giving gifts to people. Notably, if they set out their shoes, he would put coins in their shoes. And this dovetailed with the tradition of the three wise men who brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh to honor and show their support and love for a newborn babe in Bethlehem long ago. But what had occurred to me as I was studying Santa, this figure that is transmuted into a commercial salesman for Coca-Cola and 10,000 other products. And in the process, well, let me add, we talked about the pilgrims and Thanksgiving only a few days ago. And yet on Thanksgiving, they never seem to teach children that the pilgrims scarcely celebrated Christmas at all. They regarded Christmas as a holiday that had become heavily contaminated with paganism. All you really need to do is open your Bible to the book of Jeremiah to see what that's all about. Specifically, Jeremiah, the 10th chapter, the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th verses, where this great biblical prophet says, "Follow not the way of the heathen. For the heathen go into the forest, and they cut down the trees with their axes, and they decorate the tree with silver and gold." And so on. This is what we call the Christmas tree was actually part of pagan worship. There's no reference to Jesus setting up a Christmas tree in the Bible.
Go right ahead.
And so we have seen the transmutation of Christmas into something that includes pagan Yule logs, that now tells us Santa is an elf, whatever in the world that may be. A very different holiday from what the founders of Christianity expected or wanted. And yet, Santa has become a beloved figure that still incorporates some of the spirit of St. Nicholas. We'll talk about that as the show proceeds.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
While the storm clouds gather.
All right, Lowell, you go right ahead.
okay, so we're talking about whether Obamacare could kill Santa Claus, this beloved figure. Why would that be? Well, because Obamacare is taking us toward the equivalent of the British socialized national health system. And the British system kills people every day and is famous now for looking at patients and saying, oh, well, you're so obese that we've decided not to treat you for this disease. Oh, you smoke. And as long as you're a smoker, there's no point in our treating you for this disease that's killing you. And so on. Now, who is Santa as depicted today in modern advertising, in poetry, in lore, in the songs and poems we use to celebrate this gift-bringing figure at this time of year? Number one, he's a white male. That virtually condemns him right there. He's a white male who wears leather and animal furs. I mean, he's the embodiment of political incorrectness. He smokes a pipe, and smoke encircles his head like a wreath. He's grotesquely obese by today's standards of modern idealized fitness. He exploits reindeer. He cracks his whip over a non-unionized elf sweatshop 364 days a year. He leaves his wife alone on Christmas Eve at the icy North Pole. Now, I suggest that Obamacare death panels would look at Santa and say, you know, you are so old, you may be the oldest patient we've ever had to look at here, and you smoke, and you're fat, and we're just going to disallow this. And, oh, by the way, we're not influenced by the fact that you are conservative and judgmental, that you are a conservative who sees which children are naughty and nice and hands out gifts accordingly. We, the multicultural liberals of the Obama death care panel, won't weigh that in our consideration, but we've decided you will get no treatment and be left to die. Could that happen? Well, how many listening right now are overweight or smoke or are very old? And they're waiting for the death panel to say, in order to save money for younger people, we aren't going to give you, at age 83, that kidney transplant you need to survive. I'm afraid we are headed into rationed medicine, and I'm afraid part of that rationing may very well be political and ideological. So yes, Obamacare could, if he had to rely on it for treatment, Obamacare could kill Santa Claus.
I'm sure that is the case, and I think we're in for a very difficult time. Hang on, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lowell Potty, and Lowell is just saying that he is concerned that Santa Claus will cease to exist when we have our new Obamacare, that the Obamacare is going to kill Santa Claus. Obamacare is going to result in rationing of health care and basically even political restriction. If you're somebody the government doesn't like, they will be able to keep you from being able to get adequate health care, and they're certainly not going to give kidney transplants or heart transplants to someone who's 83 or 84 years of age, even though they may be in excellent health and could live another 10 years. With a transplant, they're going to determine who's going to get what medical care, and that is going to be restricted by their financial considerations, rather than, of course, giving people the opportunity to do what they want to with their own money. Now, of course, they tell us, well, we're going to provide for you, but we're going to determine what health care you're going to get. And then what we have known in the past as far as the pre-practice medicine will cease to exist when the Obama unaffordable health care bill goes through. Go right ahead.
Well, as we've discussed before, Dr. Stan, and as we discussed in our book, The Great Withdrawal, the progressive movement that largely took over our government starting in 1913, that implemented the Federal Reserve and the income tax and so on, they came from a European movement of ideology that in Europe metastasized into communism and Nazism, and here metastasized into something with elements of that. But what they all had in common is they're collectivists. They believe that God is basically dead. They repudiate and mock God for the most part. But yet, ironically, they ardently believe in Santa Claus. They ardently believe that somehow government can show up with a bag, an infinitely deep bag of free goodies to hand out to people in the form of welfare. Of course, by taking that welfare, they become addicted. They become largely helpless themselves. They're in effect living in a life of zero gravity in which their muscles, spiritual and physical, atrophy. They become weaker and weaker and more dependent on handouts. You know, I remember as a child visiting Yellowstone National Park. And all over the park in those days, and I imagine today, they had signs that said, "Don't feed the bears." Now, they had several reasons for that. They didn't want to draw the bears. They didn't want to give the bears the idea that they somehow had a right to smash the windows in your car in order to grab your ice chest or otherwise to take your food. But most of all, they were concerned because when young bears become habituated to just taking food handouts from visiting humans, they quickly lose the ability to feed themselves. They lose their skill at hunting. They lose their skill at tracking. They lose their skill at being self-sufficient in that environment, all because of the handouts. And yet, while we are caring enough to say, "Don't feed the bears, it will destroy their independence," somehow we don't say that about human beings. We believe it's perfectly okay to give currently 108 million, about a third of our fellow citizens, welfare. And that's how many are on means-tested welfare right now. Now, there are obviously cases where people urgently need that and couldn't survive without it. But there are also many cases, as the critics like to say, of people who have turned the social safety net into a hammock, of people who just find it easier to take a handout than to go get a job.
Well, you see, Lowell, the problem is that this should never be the function of the federal government to provide for the people. In fact, our founders, when they set up this country, wanted matters dealing with life and liberty and property to be handled at the state and the local level, never to be handled at the federal level. And that is why, of course, they created the Constitution to limit the power of the federal government so that the people would not be able to vote themselves into slavery. Our founding fathers realized that a government that can provide for the people is going to be able to control the people. And once we gave the government the ability to provide for the health and the welfare of our public, they would be able to control them. That's why initially we had charity, and charity was taken care of at the family level, it took care of at the church level, and at the local community level. And every city and every county in this entire nation had a county hospital, and the county was responsible for providing free care for people who couldn't afford it, and partial care for people who could afford partial payment. And nobody went without medical care in 1950. And I will tell you that very soon people are going to be dying in America because they won't be able to afford, won't be able to get health care as our federal government rations it. And the entire concept of what's going on today is unconstitutional, is subversive and treasonous. And nobody wants to say that. Obamacare is a subversive legislation aimed at making the federal government responsible for the health of the people. And that is totally unconstitutional and treasonous, in my opinion. Go ahead.
And since in a state like yours and mine, California, there are now indications that as much as 70% of practicing physicians in the state, they simply stop treating Obamacare patients. So you'll have a piece of paper that says you're insured, but just try to get treated in that situation. That, of course, will then move us to the next step in socialized medicine, which is that physicians will be, in effect, drafted by the government. Physicians will be told, if you wish to practice medicine at all, you are required to treat X number of Obamacare patients or X percentage of Obamacare patients among those you care for. In other words, doctors will be drafted and enslaved to practice that sort of medicine because that will be the only way the government... You see, people don't appreciate that, as you do, being a physician, the implications of an Obamacare that believes it can give away generous gifts and then make other people pay for the gift. So even under Medicare, certainly under Medicaid, what the government does is give away highly discounted or free medical care, and then expect the hospitals and the doctors to pay for it by taking incredibly low rates of payment for what they do. This is why when you go into a hospital and you do have private insurance, they will charge you $10 or $15 for an aspirin. because you're being expected to pay for all those people who come in and don't pay, or all those people on government programs who come in where the hospital is paid and the doctor is paid only a tiny fraction of what they would receive from other patients. So the private insured medical patients then get devastated. You mentioned welfare, and of course there is this phrase in the Constitution that one of the functions of government is to provide for the general welfare. That phrase was put in, encoded by James Madison, who became the fourth president of the United States. And Madison, keeping notes on the Constitutional Convention, was very clear in saying the reason we called it the general welfare was to make absolutely certain no one would ever confuse this with individual welfare. In other words, the general welfare is something that benefits everyone, like making a new road or building a new courthouse or something. It was never intended, the general welfare, to be mistaken for the idea of taking money from one citizen just to give it to another citizen. When John F. Kennedy was president of the United States, more than 50% of every tax dollar went for national defense. Today, two-thirds of every tax dollar goes for transfer payments, which is to say, just taking a dollar out of Dr. Stan Monteith's pocket so that it can be put into the pocket of someone else, the politicians, deem more worthy of getting the fruits of your labor than you are. In other words, the government has just become a giant money transfer machine. And as you and I understand only too well, a lot of Obamacare is simply a wealth redistribution program. It is simply designed to take money from some Americans and transfer that to others in the form of medical benefits, payments, drugs, and so on.
But, of course, the difficulty is that it's going to be so much more expensive. And people certainly, the whole idea is that everybody is going to pay their fair share. You'll not be able to charge people more money just because they have a pre-existing condition or because they're getting older. So you're going to find people, certainly, than 55 years of age. Their the premium for their health insurance is going to either triple or quadruple. In the case of my son, who's 55, why, of course, his health insurance is going to go from $4,000 a year, and this is for a catastrophic policy, not for a first dollar pay policy, catastrophic policy, from $4,000 a year to $14,000 a year, and that is going to hit all sorts of people all across this country. But, of course, they're dependent upon the young people, certainly in their 20s and 30s, to take insurance if they don't have it today. But they're going to have to pay a high sum of money for a lot of things that they're not going to benefit from, and a lot of them probably will end up paying the fine. I've forgotten how much you have to pay, but you have to pay a certain amount if you don't take out insurance. I think a lot of them are simply going to pay the fine and not take out the insurance, and the whole system will crumble because there won't be enough money to make it work. Have you run into that thought, Lowell?
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, other problems with Obamacare. They may give you a health insurance policy that under the right circumstances may only cost you $200-$400 a month. But when you actually go to get care, you discover that the deductible and the copay make the care out of reach. That is, the insurance company may not pay $1 to you in reimbursement until you have already spent $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 on your own treatment. And, of course, that means you wind up paying for almost everything you need. Only the most catastrophic conditions would bring the insurance policy into effect then.
And that, of course, is what's known as a catastrophic health policy, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, a lot of people take a $5,000 catastrophic policy because it keeps the major premium down. But basically, to give you a catastrophic policy for $14,000 a year, why, that is just out of all proportions. And basically, all across America, people are suddenly getting their hospital, pardon me, their insurance bills, and finding it's going to be skyrocketing. Our guest is Lowell Potty. We're talking certainly about Obamacare and certainly this whole idea. The government is going to take care of us, ladies and gentlemen. A government that can take care of you is going to be able to control you. Go right ahead, Lowell.
And so we were talking about Santa Claus and whether Santa Claus might be killed by Obamacare because it would look at him and say, you're incredibly old, much older than other people were, we refuse to treat. You're a smoker. You wear furs. You're grotesquely obese. You are just not a good candidate for treatment, and therefore we, the Obamacare death panels, we are going to deny you treatment altogether. I said earlier that the fascinating thing about the progressives who have put this we know what's best for you control freak program onto the necks of the American people, those people do reject God, reject Jesus and so on, but somehow miraculously they accept Santa Claus. They accept the idea that government can somehow dole out infinite benefits and the bag will never run empty. That we're all supposedly good boys and girls in that sense to be taken care of. Now, what's intriguing is when you look at Santa Claus in that context, you find that here we had a young mother I mentioned at the top of the interview writing in Slate magazine saying, in effect, what should I tell my daughter about Santa Claus? Well, tell her there really was a St. Nicholas. That's not a fantasy. That he really was a gift-giving Christian saint and a bishop of Myra in what is now Turkey. And he became legendary for all the gifts he would give to people young and old. But, of course, those were not government-extorted gifts. Those were voluntary gifts. The interesting thing, however, is that liberals believe they are entitled to play Santa. And that's the thing that she should really be telling her child if she doesn't want to lie. If she wants to tell her child the whole truth, then part of the truth you should say is when the politicians come to you dressed in a red suit with all that white ruffle on their sleeves and so on, and they say, we're here to give you things for free, an intelligent child of an appropriate age, maybe 9, 10, 12, should be able to look at that politician and say, you're not giving me anything. What you're doing is you're stealing money from my neighbors, from my own family, and then you are doling out a portion, not all by any means, but a portion of the money you simply took from my neighbors first. Because you, the government, you don't do anything. You don't make anything of value. You just sit there and confiscate wealth from some people and then buy your reelection by spreading that wealth to others as a kind of bribe. You are not really Santa, is what children should be taught to say to government. You are a fake Santa. You are an un-Santa. You are even an anti-Santa. Because what today's government does is it pretends to give gifts to children the way Santa does. You know what the government is really giving to our children and grandchildren? It is sending them the bill for all the debt that the government is now running up, spending on us today. It is dumping that debt unto children who haven't even been born yet, whose lives and opportunities, whose future will be circumscribed and limited, who will have to live in a much poorer, less free America because of the huge debt the politicians, by playing Santa, are building up today. In other words, don't tell your child that the Santa standing in front of the neighborhood department store is a fake. That should be pretty obvious.
Hold that thought, Lowell. We'll be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Lowell is simply talking about Santa Claus. Is Santa Claus real? Well, what do you tell your child about Santa Claus? But basically, well, the one thing we don't want is for people to think that the government is Santa Claus. The government can provide us with things. Government cannot provide us with anything. The government simply redistributes money, takes money from one group and gives it to another to buy their votes, so the politicians can basically maintain their position in office. But unfortunately, what they're doing is today they're running up a massive debt. Remember, it took us 200 years to accumulate suddenly about $1 trillion in debt. Today, we are accumulating over $1 trillion in debt every single year. When Barack Hussein Obama came into office, the national debt was $10.7 trillion. Today, it's over $17 trillion. That's gone up over $6.4 trillion in less than 5 years. This is not happening by accident. It's happening by intent. And basically, this is leaving a legacy of debt for our children and our grandchildren. We're going to live very well, but sooner or later that money's going to have to be paid off. And, of course, it's going to be paid off by people losing their freedom and certainly destruction of the value of our currency. And if not in this generation, then in generations yet unborn. Go right ahead, Lowell.
You put it so well, Dr. Stan. Yes, what people are going to pay this in is in the form of inflation, in the form of higher taxes, in the form of less opportunity, in the form of America's wealth and position in the world deteriorating as we squander our birthright here. This country, for its first century and a half, accumulated tremendous wealth, land, opportunity, and we are now just spending that seed corn as fast as we can. If you look at something like Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty and Great Society programs, the thing that was so enchanting about the War on Poverty is not only has poverty won, not only do we have even more poor people today than when that war began, but the reality is the poor have become simply a pretext for bigger government. What do I mean? I mean, as experts have calculated, for every $1 that the government allocated to help the poor, only about 18 to 20 cents ever actually got to the poor people. 80 cents of that dollar was eaten up by all the intervening people who live on the poverty industry in this country. All the jobs for social workers, all the political jobs for political appointees and operatives being paid more than $100,000 a year. It just became a way of dispersing government money, most of which never got to the hands of the poor at all. Now, Milton Friedman, the Nobel laureate economist, looked at that and said, well, if we really care about the poor, in America today, Dr. Stan, our government is spending approximately $63,000 for every poor family in the country. Now, what if we just took that money, said Milton Friedman, and gave it directly to the poor? Answer, there would be no more poverty. It would just vanish. However, once you did that, all those people who have their jobs as social workers and so on, and appointees, based on helping the poor, they'd be out of work. They'd actually have to go find something honest to do with their lives. So therefore, the irony of all the poverty programs is, job one is make sure the poor people stay poor. Because if they escape from poverty, if there are suddenly fewer and fewer poor people, then there will be fewer and fewer of us whose jobs are based on helping the poor. And so it's become a huge trap. It's become a vast mechanism just to justify the dispersal of government money into all kinds of hands. And as you say, nothing in the original Constitution, nothing in the vision of America's framers and founders justifies this. This is all the kind of thing they fled from Europe to get away from. And yet, we have now developed a European-style welfare state, the characteristics of which are high unemployment. Oh, by the way, you might have noticed they claim that unemployment went down again in the November jobs report. Of course, when you look at that, there was a whole lot of gimmickry in those numbers. And if you look at the year as a whole, the government now claims to have created 1 million jobs, and yet 2.5 million fewer people are in the workforce than at the beginning of 2013. It's all a shell game.
Yes, it's unfortunate, but the information you're getting from the government statistics simply is to deceive you. Our economy is contracting. There are less and less people to work out there. More and more people, of course, going to work for government. And basically, I had read one recent report that instantly the 230,000 new jobs created last month. Why, of course, about about 60% of them were working for government. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that said that only about 70,000 of the jobs were government jobs. All the rest were private industry. Somebody's lying, ladies and gentlemen.
Storm clouds gather.
Ahead.
Well, there is vast amounts of manipulation that goes into government numbers nowadays because those are the numbers that justify government programs. As to the idea that 41% of the recently employed were government employees, that's quite true, but a lot of that number was actually those employees who were temporarily laid off and then brought back by the government after spending weeks receiving unemployment checks. So the employees were temporarily laid off. They immediately ran to other government offices and applied for unemployment. They pocketed the unemployment checks. Then they came back to work for the government, and they were immediately given back pay for the time they were away. And that's where some of those new government employees came from. Actually, the real number is not nearly as dramatic as 41%. Experts now say that was a slight mistake by the Cybercast News Service in doing that analysis. And yet, it tells us a great deal about the nature of government today. I mean, we look at our gross domestic product, for example, and we say, well, America at least has some wealth there. We have a gross domestic product of about 16 and a fraction trillion dollars that we're generating every year. No, 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 boys and girls. 39% of that is accounted for in spending by federal, state, and local governments. That's almost $4 out of 10 counted in our gross domestic product, which isn't really a product at all. It's just another use of money taken from taxpayers that otherwise would have been in the economy doing productive things. But instead, that money is spent by and for the government to make the government larger. And the problem, of course, is the larger the government gets, the hungrier it gets, the more it demands to be fed. And when government demands to be fed, it doesn't really have the same kind of bad debt collection that the private sector confronts. The government just takes its armed operatives and goes out and seizes property when it is not paid the taxes it wishes. So government is this, dare we say, soon all-consuming beast.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's a little potty. Simply talking about government ever expansion, government ever spending more money, and suddenly government regulating the people from the cradle to the grave. Well, before we go on, would you like to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you and certainly with your partner, how they can get your books, basically, that you offer, and basically books to explain to people what's really going on in the world today, and your program to write a dozen books to try to educate the people about the very tragic situation that we face today?
Well, we're also trying to show people that there's cause for optimism, that in fact the progressives who have ruled us for 100 years are now weakening their grip, they are losing their power, they're losing their public support, they're in a panic, which is why they've gone from the usual kind of brainwashing, bribery, and addictive use of hallucinatory money to buy people off, and they're going now just toward brute force. This is why, for example, the Tea Party people found themselves attacked by the IRS, used as a political weapon. Why the government is now doing mass surveillance of all citizens. Why even local governments are now, with government and federal encouragement, beginning to monitor people's telephone calls and so on. Why we're entering a surveillance state that is using increasingly regulatory power to terrify people, to bully them into silence and compliance, with what the government wants by just beating down those who are openly opposed to this current administration. But the main intent of our book, The Great Withdrawal, is a survival guide. It is to show people not only how they've been abused, tricked, manipulated, had their money stolen by the government, but also how they can fight against that, how we can use decentralized technologies to undo the government's attempt to create more and more centralized power in Washington, D.C., how you can protect your family and your life savings from a lot of the manipulation government now has been doing with our money, for example, how you can understand that the government is literally fast approaching seizing your IRA, your 401k, your other retirement plan money, just as they did in Argentina in 2008. Where very, very soon you're going to wake up, or people who still have such things are going to wake up and discover that the government has replaced the money in their retirement account with government bonds that will pay a government annuity of a fixed amount, but you will no longer be allowed to withdraw your savings and spend them. You will just receive an annuity like Social Security for the rest of your life from what had been your retirement account. Oh, and by the way, the bonds that they use to pay you, what they did in Argentina, people woke up to find that if they had $1,000 in their retirement account, that had been replaced by a face value Argentinian bond of $1,000. The only problem is the real market value of the Argentinian bond was only about $270 out of 1,000. So in other words, it was only worth 27% of its face value. So overnight, the government stole, what would that be, 73%, somewhere thereabouts, of the entire value of people's savings just by transmitting. And our government, even now, is already talking, in some cases, openly. They were talking openly about doing this in 2010. They've more or less gone underground. They've transferred the power to do that to this new government agency set up by Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama, an agency that is not even funded by the Congress. It is funded directly by the Federal Reserve, and accordingly, the Congress has almost no power, certainly no power of the purse strings, to rein it in. And that's how parliaments traditionally worked. I mean, the way Congress has power to control the government is Congress controls the money. But it doesn't control the money of this new government agency that already says it is looking into how it is going to make retirement accounts universal for all Americans by confiscating the accounts of those who have a lot and basically sharing that wealth with people who have little or nothing today. That's what they're now planning. We know this. Anyway, the book helps people survive things like that and shows you what they're on the verge of doing. This is all heavily documented and footnoted for you. And it's an amazing 250-page read. My co-author, Craig Smith, would be more than happy to send anyone who'd like one a free copy of this 250-page, $20 at the bookstore book. We'll pay for the postage. We'll pay for the book. We'll even pay for the phone call to get it. And all you need to do, and you can have it by Christmas, by the way, if you call now, 800-630-1494 is the toll-free number to call. 800-630-1494, or as I like to say, to help people remember, you know, how Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Think of that. 1-800-63, it's not quite 1492, but it's close. 800-630-1494. And when you get the little robot on that line, just leave your name and phone number. We'll get back to you. We'll find out what form you'd like a book in, a Kindle form or paper or whatever. And this way, we'll also be able to inform you when the next 8 books in our series come out.
And basically, what is the title of the book?
The book is The Great Withdrawal, How the Progressives' 100-Year Debasement of America and the Dollar Ends. Yes, it does refer to people withdrawing money from their bank accounts, which, as people learned in the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean less than a year ago, the government is quite capable of rushing in and simply confiscating all or part of your bank account. And they've laid the legal basis for doing that. You know, a lot of people think foolishly that when you put a bank account in a bank, that the money is yours. But under the law, the way it's written, it's not yours. You have created an unsecured loan with that bank. It is now the bank's money. They've given you an IOU in the form of a bank book, saying they intend to pay you back. But if the government decides to come in and seize the bank's money, the government will seize your bank account too, and you will have no recourse. You will have no guaranteed way to get your money back if and when the government does that, because you turned it into the bank's money when you put it in the bank. A lot of people think, oh, we have a Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. They guarantee bank accounts for up to $250,000. And I was smart enough, you say, to have taken my $1 million savings, my life savings, and put it in four different accounts in that bank. Oh, no, 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 boys and girls. Even if they did guarantee it, and they don't really have the backing to do that anyway, in a serious crisis, they couldn't possibly cover how much would be lost. I mean, they have at most $500 billion, and we're looking at they're covering $7 to $11 trillion worth of bank accounts in America. They have no possible way to cover them if there was a real state national crisis and there was a mass withdrawal from the banks here. It also refers to withdrawal like from addictive drugs, because government welfare, government benefits, and easy money on Wall Street supplied by the Federal Reserve to the amount of $1 trillion a year, that has been an addictive drug. And when that drug is cut off suddenly, or when that drug becomes so debased by inflation that it has no value anymore, you're going to see half the country undergoing massive withdrawal symptoms, just like a drug addict. And it will be very unpleasant. And some people will have taken the right steps and protected themselves, and some won't. And this book is designed to help you protect yourself from that, too. The number, again, to get the book absolutely free is 800-630-1494. We'll pay the postage. We'll pay for the phone call. We'll, of course, pay for the book. Why does Craig do this? Because he woke up one day already in retirement as a wealthy young man, a self-made, you know, businessman who succeeded tremendously. And he said, you know, the country is going to hell in a handbasket for my children and grandchildren. We have to do something to bring back the republic, restore the Constitution, make government small again, create sound money, real money, unlike what we now use in Federal Reserve notes. And so we've embarked on writing these dozen books to arm people with information. Up till now, people have been largely disarmed. They didn't know what the government was really doing to them. Now they're beginning to wake up and see that Obamacare is just the tip of the iceberg. The government has been doing this to you in almost everything it's done. And so here we are trying to help the people. And as I say, the book is totally free. It will not cost you a penny. But you have nothing to lose by calling 800-630-1494 and getting the book, The Great Withdrawal.
And it's a fascinating book. I certainly have read about half of it, and it's well done. I think it's vitally important people understand that we have a monetary system with nothing behind it. It's all based upon trust. And unfortunately, other countries throughout the world are losing trust in our economic system. And that is why certainly a number of countries have actually come to agreements with communist China, which has accumulated a great deal of gold, and India, certainly, and Russia, and a couple of other countries, I think South Africa included in that, certainly are forming a monetary union, and they're trading among themselves using the Chinese yuan as the basis for their currency. America's certainly ascendancy in the world has to do with the fact we have the reserve currency, but of course that is assuming that we had certainly not massive debts. What we've done is we've developed a massive debt. 20 years ago, we were the greatest nation in the world financially. Today, we're the greatest debtor nation in the world. And other countries are beginning to lose confidence in the dollar. How long the dollar will remain the reserve currency, I don't know. But increasingly, people throughout the world are beginning to get more and more fearful about the stability of the dollar. And if there ever some major cataclysmic event were to take place, well, the dollar could simply lose its value literally overnight, because there's nothing behind it. There's no gold backing to the dollar, and under those circumstances, why, we could certainly impoverish the vast majority of the people in this country almost literally within the wink of an eye. But go right ahead, Lowell.
Well, the dollar is now a kind of hallucination. And the problem is that the moment people snap out of that hypnotic spell, the moment people look at the dollar and say, wait a minute, this is based on the full faith and credit of the country, but you've run your credit out to the end and beyond. I mean, you've now for many years followed a policy where the U.S. runs up debt on a credit card, and when that debt comes due, they just pull out another credit card and pay the debt with that. We've come to a time when China originally bought $1.3 trillion of our debt. Japan bought nearly that much. In fact, for years, debt has been the single biggest export of the United States in the world market. That is our debt paper. But now, so few people are buying it that the Federal Reserve buys more than 90% of all our debt whenever there's a bond auction in the world. In other words, we're just taking credit out of our right pocket and putting it into our left pocket and pretending that we're covering the debt, when in fact we're just printing money. The Fed is just conjuring money out of thin air like a magician, money that is backed by nothing, no added productivity at all. And what do we have to show for that? Well, the stock market is above 16,000. The stock market was hitting record levels. The stock market is a casino. That's like saying that a casino in Las Vegas has hit record levels of people wagering in it. It means nothing. The stocks are rising based on no increase in productivity, except insofar as they fired a lot of people and cut their overhead. And that has made them a little more profitable. But they've pretty much come to the end of that. They fired about as many people as they could fire and still stay in business. So that kind of cost savings, the only way they can save money now basically is by leaving the country and going to a lower cost environment on the planet. And of course, when they do that, you can kiss the jobs and whatever prosperity the company brought here goodbye. If you have a record number of Americans renouncing their U.S. citizenship, because we are one of those odd countries in the world that says if you are an American citizen and you go make a good living in England or Australia or Zimbabwe or wherever you make your money, we will tax it just because you're a U.S. citizen. You know, a lot of other countries like Great Britain don't do that. If you go make a fortune outside Great Britain will not oppressively tax you for the money you've made outside the country. What possible real moral claim would they have to it? And yet the U.S. does that. Tina Turner, of Ike and Tina Turner, the great singer, who has lived in Switzerland for many years, she just renounced her citizenship as Obama threatens to raise American taxes even more, because she says, I've lived in Switzerland for 25 years. I don't even identify with the United States anymore. Why should I be made to pay higher taxes just because I have an American passport? And that's where a lot of the most productive, creative people in the world are going. That is, they are simply moving away from the U.S., either by moving their company overseas or moving themselves overseas, all because we're supposed to be a free enterprise country, and yet among all major countries, we have the highest taxes on business of any country on earth. Communist China does not tax business as heavily as we tax them, and yet we claim to be a capitalist country. And this is just surreal.
Well, right? Of course, it is my contention, Lowell. The reason that we have a 35% corporate tax on American corporations is so that we would encourage them to go overseas. Because if you or I go overseas to make money, we have to pay taxes on it. If you're an American corporation, you move overseas, you don't have to pay any taxes. So basically, by tax, just creating that sort of a situation, we are actively encouraging our major corporations to move overseas. Most people don't understand that. But the real objective of the people in positions of power is to force our corporations overseas, to take the jobs overseas, to build up the living standards in countries throughout the world, and to lower the living standards here. Yeah. People don't understand why more and more people are moving suddenly from the middle class into the lower class. Why we now we have almost 50,000, I think 49 million 49 million Americans on food stamps, or almost that many. We only had, I think it used to be 1 in 56 people was on food stamps. Now it's 1 in 6.5 people are on food stamps here. And it's simply because we're closing down our industries here, and it's being done actively and purposely and intentionally. And there's not one person in 1,000 who understands how they're using the corporate tax structure to force our country, many of our companies, to move overseas. Our guest has been Lowell Potty. Certainly it's been fascinating to talk to Lowell. The book that he's offering certainly is excellent. One more time, do you want to get the telephone number so people can call you?
Oh, sure. To get the book absolutely free, just leave your name and phone number at 800-630-1494. That's 800-630-1494. And you'll get absolutely free and postpaid a copy of The Great Withdrawal. And you'll get it before Christmas.
And basically, of course, remember, this is an answering machine, but they will call you back, and they did call us back. So we called it, got the book, and we've had it, enjoyed it. We'll be back in just a minute to wrap up tonight's program right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Lowell, you've got about 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And it's been a great pleasure, as always, to be with you, Dr. Stan. Thank you for having the courage to be a beacon of life and truth to people out there. Now, one of the other reasons that our progressive politicians love to impose corporate taxes is either they will drive the corporation overseas, or they will turn the corporation into a tax collector for them. And so the politicians, rather than taxing ordinary people like you and me, who are already heavily taxed, I mean, the Tea Party does stand for taxed enough already, is when they impose taxes on corporations, what do corporations do? They don't pay the tax. They turn around and add the cost of the tax to the price of what they're selling to you and me. Most people don't know that when you buy a new car, half the cost of the new car is taxes, tariffs, imposts, and so on. That's all concealed from you. And then those same politicians stand up and say, look at those greedy capitalists, how much money they're charging you for their product. If you could see how much of the cost you pay for everything is actually passed on taxes that the government levied on the corporation that made the product, you would be stunned and amazed. And that is, in fact, one of the projects of a future book we're doing. But for now, I hope people will take a moment and get the survival guide for our economic situation today, The Great Withdrawal, How the Progressive 100-Year Debasement of America and the Dollar Ends. This is a book with optimism in it. It shows you there is still great hope for restoring the republic in the United States if people are informed, and that's why we're trying to inform you. Absolutely free, just call 800-630-1494. Get your copy postpaid of the book. It will not cost you a penny. I do have to warn you, though, you read this book, you will never be able to view politics or economics the same way again. You will be astonished at just how manipulated we all have been through our lives by what they've done to us. And, of course, I had the experience some time ago, Dr. Stan, of opening a newspaper, and there was a quiz. And the quiz says, which of these 10 automobiles was made in the United States? And it listed Chevrolets and Fords and Chryslers and so on. And it turned out, at the end of the quiz, the only car that was actually made in the U.S. was a Nissan. All of the American name cars were made in Canada, Mexico, or elsewhere. In fact, a billion and a half of the money that the U.S. government spent on automaker General Motors did wind up creating new jobs and building new auto facilities. Half a billion.
Hold that thought.
Half a billion was spent in Mexico, and a billion was spent in Brazil.
Well, certainly, as Lowell is pointing out, that a lot of the automobiles here sold in America, like Chevrolet, Buick, others, are actually not manufactured in the United States. They're manufactured in Brazil. They're manufactured in Canada. They're manufactured in Mexico. But you're not knowing about that. Oh, suddenly, some of the Japanese cars are actually manufactured here by American workers, but so many of the major American corporations are not producing their vehicles here. We're out of time, Lowell. Have to get back and get more information on that at a later time, but thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, God bless you and God bless America. We wish you the happiest of holidays, Dr.
And to you as well. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Lowell Ponte, and we do hope you enjoy him. Lowell has a wonderful ability to express himself clearly and concisely with accurate information, and we certainly enjoy having him as a guest here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is the time when I need to remind those of you out in the listening audience that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. I do not take a salary. My wife doesn't take a salary. We work full-time just simply to educate people about the dire circumstances that face our nation today, and that behind everything going on are powerful supernatural spiritual forces. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. You get it by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, if you certainly don't have the funds for that, you can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com, scroll down under videos, and you'll actually see the talk from which the book came. It's called Brotherhood of Darkness, and you can watch it there for nothing. And then, of course, we do hope you'll make it a regular program to go to our website, and you can listen to our radio programs there live 4 hours a day, archived 24 hours a day, because remember, we do 5 hours of talk radio a day, and 4 hours of talk radio a day are left there on our website. And then, of course, we hope that you'll read our newsletters there on the website, that you'll certainly encourage others to go to our website. There's all sorts of fascinating things there on the Georgia Guidestones on population control. And we're going to start this. Basically, we have one segment there. Other videos on the web, and we encourage you to go there. A lot of very interesting video footage. And we're going to make it a program on a regular basis to actually get more and more information on that website so that you can go there, hopefully, at least every week and get all sorts of well worthwhile information. We're just starting on that. We won't be getting to it for the next day or two. But after that, we hope you'll go to RadioLiberty.com, go to the section on other videos on the about the web, and encourage others to do the same. Then, of course, we hope if you have not yet seen Pastor Billy Crone's series of DVDs, The Final Countdown, each one has 4 or 5 DVDs in it. And basically, they simply take you into the fact that we're living in truly prophetic times. There are 8 segments here, each one with 4 or 5 DVDs. Part 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Pastor Billy Crone does a wonderful job on The Final Countdown. We recommend it to you. And the telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Then if you are concerned in the least bit about the threat of an EMP attack, we suggest our 4-CD set on the threat of an EMP attack or the DVD on the threat of an EMP attack. We have a great DVD of talk I gave on Agenda 21, The Covert Plan. Agenda 21, of course, is the master plan for what's going on today. It is a subversive movement that certainly has branches in every county in the United States. And you'll want to hear my talk on Agenda 21, The Covert Plan. And you'll also want to get Michael Shaw's excellent DVD. Just call and ask for Michael Shaw's DVD. On Agenda 21, he does an excellent job. You'll certainly want to get my talk. It's called Population Control, The Secret Agenda, Population Control, The Secret Agenda. And then we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but we ask you specifically to pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and protection.
Let us swear allegiance. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. It is New Year's Eve morning. Welcome to the Power Hour. It is January 31st, 2013. It is Tuesday, and you're in the right place. Thank you so much for joining us, caring about your world.